Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome to the Daily Jungle. Postseason baseball is finally here, and the Twins got it started by choking away that first inning lead in about 5 minutes. The Yankee bats smashed, who you clones glossed, Irvin Gascana, and their pen did the rest. We were all over that first wildcard game, including Gary Sanchez's absolutely brutal foul tip to the junk. We also had three excellent guests: UCF head football coach Scott Frost, PGA Tour pro and President's Cup badass Daniel Berger, and Yahoo Sports columnist and third place Smackoff finisher Jeff Passan. All of that and maybe the best ATP we've ever had. Alvy, roll it right now. Now let me start with the AL wildcard. Going into last night, I think everybody knew Minnesota's horrible record against New York in Yankee Stadium. We talked about it before the game. Everybody knew that going in. Everybody also knew the fact that the Yankees have bumped the Twins off in four of their last five postseason appearances. So things were looking pretty bleak for Minnesota when Yankee starter Luis Severino hit 100 on the radar gun with his first pitch. It didn't look good at all. In fact, it looked really bad. You're going into a place where you never ever win, and the first pitch is a triple-digit heater. Bad things, yo. Bad things. But then Brian Dozier did this to his fifth pitch.
And the 3-1 pitch, a swing at a fly ball, left center field, deep in the gap. Back goes Gardner. Gardner at the wall. Gardner will not make a play. It's a home run. A leadoff home run for Brian Dozier. Just cleared the wall in left center field, and there's a spark and there's a start. 1-0 Twins.
Uh-oh. Twins radio. That's what's known as a plot twist. Maybe Minnesota had something after all. Severino gets the next batter out, walks the next one, and then comes Eddie Rosario. One out, one on.
And the 1-1 pitch, a fly drive to right, down the line, deep in the corner. That's going to land over the wall, home run! Eddie Rosario with a line drive homer to right. Yankee Stadium is stunned. Twins have a 3-0 lead. Four batters in.
Three runs, two homers, one out. 4-3-2-1. It's a hell of a statement right there. The kind of statement that will change the narrative. They added a single and a double, and Severino is gone. And you know the Twins were thinking, we got this thing. We got it. We got it. But that's not what happened. They get out to that early lead. Then the Yankees come back. The joint is rocking. They tie it up when there's a bomb. And then the Twins fans have to be thinking, why is it always the Yankees? Why? Why? Like Cruz and Ghana.
It's the World Cup. It's the World Cup, bro. We had a chance.
Why is it the Yankees? 3-3. Can I tell you something?
We lost to Ghana.
When they tied that game up, that game was over right then. No sooner than the bat hit the ground, that game was over right there. If you get an ace out and you take that early lead and you knock out their ace, one out into the game, and you can't come back from that, it's never meant to be. Because once that game was tied, it was over. Minnesota had their chance, and they blew it in the first. Because then the Yankee bullpen went to work. 26 outs, 13 of which were strikeouts. And for all that talk about Aaron Judge, and he was great, going yard in his postseason debut, what that was really about last night was Chad Green, David Robertson, Tommy Canley, Aroldis Chapman. They won the game. They saved the Yankees season. Minnesota's bats and their own bullpen had no answer. Not like Kent Herbeck and Joe Nathan were walking through that door. So as much as that was about what the Yankees did, and they mashed, their bullpen came in and shut it down. That was about what the Twins did not do. That was a massive choke job. They could have choked out the Yankees, and instead they choke out themselves. Again, chase the opposing team's ace after one out in the first inning, and you should win that game. You have to win that game. And yet Minnesota finds a new way to lose. And I hate to say it, but that's why you're the Twins and they're the Yankees. That's going to leave a mark, a serious scar that is going to sting the entire offseason, and probably much longer than that. Which, frankly, for Minnesota, that's a big drag. Just reaching the postseason this year was an amazing accomplishment after they lost 103 games last season. there was a lot to be proud of. But it's hard to remember any of that because of what happened last night from the bottom of the first on. Again, it was right there for them. Great top half of the first, and then a disaster from that point on. I'd say don't sweat it, Twins fan. It's not like you're not used to it, but that was some next-level tanking, even for the Twins and even against the Yankees. Again, knocking out the other guy's ace, one out into a win-or-go-home playoff game, and then still getting blown out is not easy to do, even for the Twins. Yet here we are. Here we freaking are. Congrats on a great season. Condolences on how it ended. That was maybe the most Twins thing ever. Man, you knew bad things were going to happen, but I didn't expect that to happen. You can't knock out the other guy's ace, one out into the game, and still get blown out in a wild card game. But the Twins somehow managed that. 1-800-636-8686. And as for the Yankees, I've never seen that stadium rocking like that. That's the first time since they moved into that joint that I thought about the old stadium, Yankee Stadium. And Yankee fan is feeling it. And they're gearing up for a big, big matchup with the Indians, who are a juggernaut. Best of five, ALDS. Listen, these days, you can get practically everything on demand, like our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it, 24/7. As an example, we grind out every single day here on the program. Back in the day, if I had to get something out, or I had to get something to a potential guest or a team, I'd have to leave the office and get to the post office. It was horrible, and I will never do that ever again, and nor should you. Use Stamps.com. Do not interrupt what you're doing to leave for the post office. And right now, use my name, Rome, for this very special offer. It's a 4-week trial. It includes postage and a digital scale. But don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone. It's at the very top of the homepage and type in Rome. Again, Stamps.com, code name Rome. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office ever again. I know I won't, and neither should you. Head coach Scott Frost. All right, so Saturday night was your conference opener against Memphis, a team, Scott, that beat UCLA a few weeks back. You took a 6-0 lead. They came back to take a 7-6 lead in the first, and then you rattled off 34 straight points. It's a continuation of a trend where you guys get better as the game goes on, especially in the second half. So what's that tell you about the mental and physical toughness of your team?
I love our team right now. We got a bunch of guys that love football. They're playing hard for each other and with each other. I like where we're at as a football team. I feel like we're getting better every week.
You know, last year you either led or were tied at halftime against Temple, Houston, and Tulsa, but maybe didn't finish the games the way you would hope to. What's the biggest difference then from last year to this year?
You know, Jim, I think that's just the evolution of a football team as it's growing. We were good enough to be in those games last year, but I'm not sure we had enough to finish it. Part of it is guys not just thinking they can win, but believing they can win and understanding maybe what it takes to finish some of those football games. We had some of those leads last year and weren't able to hold on to them, and I think we have a more mature team that's more ready to do that this year.
And it seems like a greater belief and a greater confidence, and that's going to go a long way. UCF head coach Scott Frost is my guest. So then with the win over Memphis, you're in the top 25 for the first time since 2013. Scott, I know the fans are pumped up, but how significant is it to you? In other words, is it a milestone worth noticing, or is the focus to just charge on?
Yeah, it's more charge on. To be honest with you, I want our guys to ignore it. I want our coaching staff to ignore it. You know, a ranking at this point of the season is an honor, but it doesn't mean anything. We've only played 3 games because of the hurricane. We have a lot in front of us, and I'll be more concerned with where we are at the end of the season than I am right now.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to that point in a minute that you've only played 3 games. But then when the team met, or when you met with the team on Monday, you asked them, what's your record and where are you ranked? What was their response?
They knew the right answer. I think they had the test in front of them already, so they cheated. But they gave me the right answer. They said they're 0-0. They said they're not ranked. That's the mentality I want our guys to have. We had an unusual start to our season, but now we have 8 games left, 8 weeks in a row, and we got to be at our best in those.
All right, so what about that? You've only played three games, and it's because of delays and cancellations. So how have you gone about managing those challenges as a program?
It was tough. You know, it's not anything you have a blueprint or a plan for. So we tried to make the best plan that we could and operate in the best way we could. I got to give the guys credit, and I think it's another testament to the type of players we have on this team that they were able to hit that curveball. There was a lot of things thrown at them that they weren't expecting, and I think they handled it great. And despite the break in action, we're able to prepare really well for two good teams.
UCF's 3-0. Scott Frost, head coach, joins us. Now, the fact that we're talking about being ranked, though, is amazing. When you arrived, the team was coming off an 0-12 season. You went to a bowl game last season. Shortly after you took that job, we talked about the challenge that you were coming into. Scott, as you look back on that, was it pretty much what you expected when you took that job, or maybe was it a little bit different?
You know, there were a lot of things that needed to be fixed, but I think there's guys on the team that had won before. And I think the thing that surprised me as much as anything was the players' attitude. They didn't have the type of attitude where they believed they should have been 0-12. Talking to those guys individually, there's a lot of confidence and belief on the team that they could achieve more and that they should be achieving more. I think that made them hungry for kind of a new way of doing things and a new approach. And maybe because of the record they had, they bought into everything that we asked them to do immediately and completely. And their buy-in to our way of doing things is really what's accelerated this.
See, I think in part you answered my next question, but I was going to say, if you go from winless to a bowl game and you immediately turn around a defense going from 117th nationally to 42nd in the country in points allowed, how were you able to get that kind of an impact that quickly?
Well, like I said, we have athletes on the team and we had them. This is the best place in the country to recruit, in my opinion. We had a bunch of talent. We were able to supplement it with some more guys that we were able to recruit. And I got to give a big shout out and a bunch of credit to my defensive coordinator, Eric Shenander. He's done an unbelievable job as a first-time defensive coordinator, and he's got those guys playing hard. It makes a big difference in our games.
UCF coach Scott Frost joining us. A big part of that defense, Scott, is my guy, Shaquem Griffin, who came on the show last year. He had a monster game against Memphis, 8 tackles, a sack, a forced fumble. For those who don't know, he has one hand, and yet he dominates. What's it been like coaching him?
Well, he's your guy. He's my guy, too. He's fun to watch, and we're just thrilled to have him. You know, that play he made in the game, Memphis had the ball inside our red zone a few times, and that was really the first time. And they certainly could have came away with points in those situations, and I think it would have been a dogfight. But our players stepped up. Shaq led the charge with that strip sack, and we got the ball back. He's the type of player that is going to find a way to make a play. He hadn't played much before we got here, and we think we got him in the right position. He became Conference Player of the Year, so it's amazing what he's doing under his circumstances.
Scott, back in August, you had Tom Osborne in, and he visited you and the team. What did you take away from that time with him and your players? What was that visit like?
It was just an honor for me to have him down to speak to our players. I think our players were locked in and dialed in and listened to what he had to say. I think the best thing that we got from that is he talked about the way that we used to practice when I played with him at Nebraska. We hit during the week. We actually had some live periods on Tuesday and Wednesday, good versus good. That's something that we hadn't done the year before, and we got back to doing that, and I think it's given us a little bit of an edge physically this year.
Scott, you know how it goes, right? When you've done what you've done as quickly as you've done it, your name's going to come up for other jobs, and you know how much Nebraska fans love you. So how do you go about handling those rumors and those questions? I mean, are they flattering, or frankly, are they just a distraction?
They're both. You know, it's flattering to have your name mentioned, but I say this all the time. I have 130-some guys on this team that are sweating and bleeding and working hard for me, and it'd be a huge disservice to them for me to get distracted. I'm just going to ignore it. I want everybody in our building to ignore those types of things. I'm expecting a baby in November, and I just got to Orlando, so I feel like we have some unfinished business down here.
All right, so what about that? The baby's coming in November. How often do you find yourself thinking about that? And you know, sometimes when parents are expecting, especially for the first time, I've heard guys talk about the dreams they have. Have you had any dreams about that child?
My wife's pregnant and not sleeping, so I'm not getting enough sleep to have dreams yet.
Right. Right. So is that in the back of your mind? How you feel about that? November's the big day or the big month?
You know, we've talked about it. I'm excited. I put this off for way too long, and I'm lucky to to be having a child at this point in my life. But I think the thing I'm worried about most is when she's going to go into labor if you do, and already kind of made a decision if it happens to be during a football game. I'm not going to miss the birth of my first child. So she's a coach's wife. Hopefully she's learned that she can't have that happen during game day.
It's the right answer, by the way. But, Scott, you never know. Like, our first child, he was born during this show, and I busted out during the show, at the very end of the show, because you got to be there. You have to be there when it happens. And you never know
well,
what to expect.
If it's during a game, they're going to wonder why I'm sprinting off the field. But I think people will know.
I think they'll know. All right, so last thought. You're going on the road to face Cincinnati on Saturday night. What is your biggest concern heading into that game?
They got talent. This is a good league. It's a good football league. If you look at the American Conference, there's teams beating Power 5 teams that people wouldn't expect them to beat every year. This conference can hold its own against anybody. And every year it seems like there's a new team or a couple new teams at the top of this league. It's a league where any team can beat you on any given week if you don't play well. So going up to that place is an easy place to play, and we're going to have to be our best to get a win up there.
But the scariest moment of the night to me for the Yankees was not Severino giving up that leadoff home run to Brian Dozier, or when he gave up another bomb to Eddie Rosario, or even when he was chased after only getting one out in the first inning. The scariest moment of the night was the top of the sixth, with David Robertson on the mound, Dozier at the plate, Gary Sanchez behind the plate with Payne on the way.
Here's the payoff. He foul tip. Sanchez couldn't hang on. Sanchez is down. I don't know where the ball hit him. It hit him. Joe Girardi comes out.
And the translator. Oh. Well, you don't need the translator to tell you where that hit. Oh, boy. Ordery went down.
Yankees radio. That was brutal. Even hearing it again makes me cringe. Even hearing it again makes every man alive cringe. That ball went straight off the bat and right into the junk. Nobody, not even the staunchest, most loyal Twins fan wants to see that. And don't come in here with, well, that's why they wear cups. I don't care what kind of cup you're wearing. That's going to hurt. There's no protection for taking a rock to the fruit stand, traveling somewhere in the neighborhood at 90 miles per. You could be wearing a titanium cup with diamond inserts, and that's still going to leave a mark on Sanchez, on Robertson, on anybody who saw that. Hell, Robertson reacted like he'd just seen a car crash. First, he reacted like a hero in an 80s action film, seeing the love of his life get taken out. Like, no!
No!
Then he grabbed at his own crotch, as if feeling sympathy pains, or like protecting himself 60 feet away was going to somehow help the guy who just had his junk exploded. Then he covered his mouth with his glove. Then he crouched. Then he kept his face behind his glove in shock and pain, silently screaming to himself. For a moment, we were all David Robertson, and David Robertson was all of us. Afterwards, he summed it up by saying, quote, "Poor guy, I had a great view of it. He just took a tough shot right there. I just felt for him. I'm wearing a cup too. I just know how it feels to get hit there. It's not fun." Yeah, Dave, it's not fun. It's not fun at all. In fact, a foul tip to the Nats is the exact opposite of fun. But at least you had a great view of it. I mean, honestly, Sanchez took that better than Robertson. He was down briefly, but he got back up again, because you're never going to keep Gary Sanchez down. And somehow he stays in the game. For the life of me, I have no idea how, but somehow he stayed in the game. Anybody else in that situation stays on the ground, maybe waves for a stretcher, and then goes right to the emergency room and then retires. I was about to call for a sub for myself, and I was just watching the game at home. But the guy stays in. He singles the following inning. Catchers are always tough guys, but Sanchez has got to be the toughest of the tough. I only wish that we didn't have to learn it the way that we did last night. That was insane. Stephen Crowtown tweets, "I gave Gary Sanchez the nod for the splitter, but luckily the batter fouled it off, and now it's two balls and one strike." Signed, David Robertson. I don't understand, Steve. Where are you going with that? What does that even mean? Daniel Berger is my guest. All right, so it was your first President's Cup. Before we talk about how it went down, take me back to when it became official that you were going to be on that team. What was that moment like for you?
Oh, man, it was just so exciting. And
It's such a hard team to make. I think you know, the Ryder Cup, the President's Cup, you have to be playing so well for such a long period of time. So to know that I had kind of, you know, put my foot down and played well for a couple of years and really earned my spot on the team was really special.
Now, you did earn it, and I knew you were looking forward to it for a long time. So now that it's over, as you look back on it, what kind of memories do you have, and did it live up to your expectations?
I mean, I have nothing but amazing memories. I wish we could start back this week and do the same thing again. It was sure. Just unbelievable. But, you know, just to have all the guys together, it's just such great team camaraderie. You know, we have an amazing group of assistant captains and Jim Furyk and Davis Love III, Freddie Couples, Tiger, obviously. So just a great group of guys that we got to hang out with and learn a little bit about.
Daniel Berger joining us. Obviously, playing in a competition like the President's Cup is so different in that you have teammates and you've got guys who are relying on you. Some golfers like that, others not so much. Is that pressure something that gives you even more energy and excitement?
100%. Absolutely. I think, you know, the biggest thing was just being able to, you know, put on the red, white, and blue and play for your country. And I think that was really the most nerve-wracking thing. You want to play the best you can and deliver wins. But, you know, the international team came to play. They had a great, great team. I think we just played a little bit better.
You know, I thought you gave one of the great answers ever on Saturday when asked about the possibility of winning the cup before the singles matches even started. You said, quote, "Our goal from the minute we got here was to crush them as bad as we could. I hope that we close them out today and we go out there tomorrow and we beat them even worse," end quote. I mean, to me, that's pretty badass. Where did the attitude come from as a team? I mean, was that something that anybody brought up, or did all of you just show up with that attitude?
I mean, I think a lot of us showed up with that attitude, and, you know, I didn't want to come across as, you know, cocky or anything, but, I mean, when you're a professional athlete, I mean, every time we step out there, we're trying to win, and I'd be lying if I said otherwise, and I just feel like, you know, we took care of what we needed to do, and the end result was a win for our country.
I don't think you have anything to apologize for at all. You're right. You're a professional athlete. That's the goal. Now, as a team, you didn't finish them off on Saturday, but the team had a healthy lead. Then in the Sunday singles, you and Siwoo Kim went at it with some exciting holes like 11 where you chipped in, and then he made his putt to have the hole, and he shushed the crowd. Then on 14, he drained a long putt, and then you answered him. What was that atmosphere like?
Oh, man, it's incredible. Yeah, he pulled the little Patrick Reed finger shushing on me, but, I mean, it's just – it's a great atmosphere. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of people. I mean, you can't beat the setting with the New York skyline and like I said, to wear the red, white, and blue and to be able to compete against some of the best players in the world. That's what's really fun. You know, as a professional athlete, you look forward to trying to play against the best, and that's what this was this week.
Daniel Berger joining us. So by the time you get to 16, Stricker tells you that you had clinched the cup. When he told you that, what was that feeling like?
I mean, it was unbelievable because, you know, that was our goal when we got there. We had our sights set on the win, but, you know, I knew that there was a bunch of early tough matches, and I think we needed a point, and some of those early matches weren't going our way. So I knew if I had to I had to keep my foot on the pedal and try to get that win. And when he came over, I was just extremely excited. You know, it was a team win, but it's kind of once in a lifetime to be able to get that clinching point for sure.
Now, Daniel, you and I talked about this a little bit in the past, but the stories from when you were growing up really are legendary. Like the time your father, Jay, took you to the dive preserve where you met the assistant pro there, Matt Doyle. He watched you hit for a few minutes, then asked if you wanted to play 18, and you asked him about the stakes. You proposed a $20 closeout, and he said, "Are you good with that?" To which you responded, "Are you good with losing to a 13-year-old? My man, what do you remember about that day?
That sounds like something I would have said, but I mean, I've just always been that competitive, fiery guy. I mean, I think that's what kind of makes a difference when you're playing at this level, because everyone's so good, you have to want it more than everyone else, and that's just the way I was raised. I'm humble, but I'm still very fiery and competitive, and I think I got the best of him that day. I don't know if he'll tell you that, but I think I did.
No, I think so. Hey, listen, I don't think you're lacking in humility at all. I think you're humble. I think that you're modest. I think you're proud. But at the same time, you're going to compete. You're a competitor. You also said, "The first thing I told my dad when I turned pro is I want to play for money. I didn't want to play for all these crystal trophies. I mean, they're cool and all, but I wanted to get paid. I knew if I did the right things, I could," end quote. So what about that attitude? What about that approach? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that, you know, to be one of the best in the world, you have to do everything right. You have to work out the right way. You have to eat the right way. You have to train the right way. And I knew if I did that, then I was that I would have been good enough to, you know, play on the PGA Tour. But, you know, a lot of things went my way. You know, I can't say thanks enough to my dad who raised me the right way with the right attitude and really gave me the confidence and all the resources that I needed to be able to be the best golfer I could be.
You know, I wonder, back in the day, Daniel, maybe you wouldn't have said that, or maybe pro golfers wouldn't have gone at it like that. Like, hey, I got to do all the right things. I mean, I have to rest, I have to recover. My nutrition has to be right. My training has to be right. My weight training's got to be right. Back in the day, you wouldn't have said that or heard that from a golfer. When did that all change?
I think that's the Tiger effect. I mean, he really, I mean, if you saw what he did with his body, and obviously he's been hurt a little bit in the last couple of years, but I mean, for a while there, I mean, he was at peak performance. I mean, every time he stepped out on the golf course, he was ready to go. And, you know, people needed to get better in order to try and catch him. And I think that's something that a lot of the young golfers, the Jordan Spieths, the Justin Thomases, myself, have kind of figured out, through watching what Tiger did. If you want to win, you have to do everything you possibly can to be prepared, because that's what everyone else is doing.
So when you look at him right now, like you said, he's having lots of physical problems. Is there a cautionary tale in that, in the way he went about preparing and working out?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a little bit. I can't speak to, you know, what he was exactly doing in the gym, but I can tell you he got stronger, he got faster, he got bigger, and those are all things that you're seeing in these guys these days. We're more athletic. We hit the ball further, but there definitely is, you know, a lesson in there that you want to make sure that you take care of your body. And, you know, I want to play this game for 20 plus years. So everything I do now is to make sure that I can do that, you know, down the road.
Daniel Berger joining me for another couple of minutes. Listen, before we go off the topic of the President's Cup, how much of the attitude is what it takes to win in a competition like that? How much of it is attitude? In other words, is it more personal than playing against the field in a regular tournament? Is it different in that regard?
I think so, yeah. I think absolutely it is. Especially, like I said, I don't want to keep going back to it, but when you put on that red, white, and blue, you have this sense of pride. Like, I mean, you don't want to let anyone down. You want to do it for your country. And I think that just gets everyone a little bit more emotional, a little bit more fired up. And some of these matches, they get personal, and everyone wants to win because that's just who we are. And I think that's what kind of makes the difference between, you know, a team event like the President's Cup and a regular golf tournament.
All right, so how long after you win the President's Cup do you start thinking, or before, do you start thinking about the Ryder Cup next year?
I'm thinking about it right now. I mean, I did the Monday practice session at the Ryder Cup, I think last year, and I mean, it was unbelievable. I didn't make the team, but it was just an incredible experience. That's what really fueled me to want to make this team here, and I do not want to miss that after seeing what I saw last week at the President's Cup.
All right, so last time you were on, we talked about that sweet Rolex Yachtmaster you were rocking. How is your watch game these days? Have you picked up any new pieces?
My watch game has been a little bit better since the last time we talked, but, you know, I just like them. I don't know. That's the one thing I really like. I like watches, so.
Daniel, listen, I see you working. I know you don't want to be the guy to come on and go, oh, yeah, I bought this or I bought that or I have this, but we're just a couple of watch guys talking watches, so I'll take one more shot at it. Have you picked up any new pieces since?
I have, yeah. I got a Daytona Platinum that I really like that I saw Ricky Fowler wearing, and I was like, I got to have that one, and, you know, set some goals for myself, played well enough, and picked it up.
Jeff Passan is my guest. Good to have you back, Jeff. How are you?
Ben Smack, how are you, my friend?
Good, good. Bud, how about you? How are things?
If there weren't traffic in New York, I would be great, but I'm surviving.
I see you working. I was there last weekend. All right, so knowing the Twins' history against the Yankees, let's go right to it, Jeff. What were you thinking when Brian Dozier led off that game with a bomb, and then they added two more on an Eddie Rosario home run and chased Luis Severino in the first inning?
I was thinking that if they played two more runs, the Yankees might actually be in trouble. And they had guys on second and third with one out, Byron Buxton, who's had a tremendous second half coming up. But those two strikeouts Chad Green got to end the first inning really set the tone for the rest of the game, because that's who the Yankees are, man. They are a bullpen-first team. I described it in my column today. They're almost like a rowboat where they're steered from the back as opposed to the front. And if they, you know, if they really get a toehold here, in the early innings against the Cleveland Indians, they have a legitimate shot of dethroning the best team in the league and the defending AL champions, because their bullpen with David Robertson and Chad Green and Tommy Kahnle and Dellin Betances and Adam Warren and Aroldis Chapman at the back end really is that good.
Yeah, we'll talk more about those guys. And I agree with you, Jeff. Chad Green comes in with runners on second and third. He saves the inning, saved that game, may have saved their entire year. Then Didi Gregorius comes in, ties the game at 3-3 in the bottom of the first. What was the atmosphere like in the stadium when that happened?
It was a lot like Yankee Stadium of years past. And, you know, when they moved into the new building, it almost took on a sterile environment. The seats there cost too much. And I think, I'm not going to say the fans had become complacent necessarily, but when you win and when you get used to winning, winning just isn't as special as it once was. And the Yankees won so much there in the late 90s and early 2000s, and even with the 2009 championship, that I think fans became almost spoiled a little bit. But to see this roster that has as many homegrown players as it does and has so many more in the pipeline coming up, Yankees fans have reason to be excited because this is a potential juggernaut team that we're looking at right now. I think these Yankees are about 70% of what they can be at some point. And if a team that's 70%, considering the money they're going to have to spend and the players they have in their pipeline coming up, if they ever get to 89, even 100, I mean, we're talking about a team that can win multiple championships and be a regular fixture in the World Series.
Then the umpire's back. Jeff Passan joining us. Hey, Jeff, back to the bullpen for a minute. When you see how relievers were used in the postseason last year, and you see this bullpen, how different is the game now, especially in the postseason, than it was, say, 10 or even 20 years ago?
Well, you know, I asked Joe Girardi that question last night, and his answer was, hey, look at what we did with Mariano Rivera back in 1996. And so I did look at what happened in 1996. And that year, the relief pitchers pitched, I think, about 34% of the postseason innings. I looked 10 years after that. It was still pretty steady, right around 33, 34%. Then I looked at last year, and relief pitching was up to 42% of the innings thrown in the postseason. Starting pitchers this year had the shortest average outing in the history of baseball, only 5.5 innings per outing. And with the urgency of October and with the ability to get knocked out as quickly as your month begins, and with the great relief pitching in the game these days, and with all of the off days that are out there, because of the way that the playoffs are structured, it lends to an even more bullpen-heavy game. Relief pitchers strike out more batters than their starting counterparts, which you want in the postseason. Relievers give up fewer home runs than their starting counterparts, which is what you want in the postseason. And in a game that is so inundated with strikeouts and home runs, it only makes sense to pitch the guys who give up fewer shots and who punch out more guys.
Jeff Passan breaking it down for us, joining us once again in the jungle. He was third in the Smack Off this past year. Jeff, one thought about Aaron Judge. He's got one of five home runs, or had one of the five, and just settled in very nicely last night. It's kind of hard to remember that he's still officially a rookie. How do you explain how comfortable this guy is at this point in his career?
He's just got presence, man. I mean, it's not just that you feel it when you're around him, because anybody can fake that, right? Media is very easy to trick. But I had heard this is a too-good-to-be-true guy from a couple of people. And I remember it was in Kansas City, and Matt Holliday, whom I respect about as much as anybody in baseball, I just think he's a really smart, conscientious guy. I went up to him and I said, what do you think about Judge? And he said, he's my favorite young player I've ever played with. And when you're getting that kind of praise from Matt Holliday, someone who's been around the game, not just in the major leagues, but his father was a coach, so he has been around the game literally his whole life, it speaks volumes there. And I think Aaron Judge has the personality and the temperament to match the talent, which is a hell of a thing to say about somebody in New York. The last time we saw something like this, he was wearing number two, and that's quite the comparison to make, but one that I think at this point I'm a lot more comfortable making after seeing him do it for a year.
Jeff Passan joining us. All right, so you've got New York heading to Cleveland. You started this thought. Go ahead and finish that if you don't mind. They're going to take on a team that was an absolute monster in the regular season. How do you see the matchup going?
Well, Terry Francona made an awfully interesting decision going with Trevor Bauer in game one and saving Corey Kluber for game two so he can go on regular rest in a potential game five. Now, Trevor Bauer's been really good in the second half. There's no question about that. He seems to have found something to be fulfilling that potential that he had when he came out of UCLA and was picked third overall. That being said, and it's tough to second-guess Terry Francona, who's got two more championships than I ever will, and who almost won a third with an inferior team last October. This is the type of move that is going to be questioned and second-guessed, and especially if the Indians don't get out to an early advantage in this series. Because let's remember, all it takes is one game for the Yankees to win in Cleveland, and they've stolen home field advantage back and go to Yankee Stadium with a rested bullpen. And we saw what a rested bullpen can do for them last night. They got 26 outs from their bullpen, which is just a staggering amount. No team in baseball in 2017 had a starter last a third of an inning or less to give up three or more runs and come back to win the game.
So the Twins have that going for them, which is nice. I don't know how they ever get over that. You know, Jeff, I'd feel guilty about keeping you on for another question or two, but I know you're stuck in traffic in New York. You've got nowhere to go, nothing to do anyway. So let me ask you about the NL wild card before you go. Rockies, D-backs facing off tonight with John Gray going up against Zach Greinke. How do you like that game tonight? Who do you like?
You know, I see it as the same way I do every wild card game, which is it's a baseball game, and these are two teams that are pretty evenly matched. So to sit here and say that there's a distinct advantage on one side or another, I just don't think it's true. I think you can say that the Diamondbacks are favorites, but to me it's like a 52-48, 51-49 thing. I will take Zach Greinke over John Gray anytime, but John Gray punches out a lot of guys. He's got a big fastball, and that's the type of thing where if you're the Diamondbacks, you hope that you can get the type of offense out of J.D. Martinez and Paul Goldschmidt and A.J. Pollock and the rest of that team that you've gotten all year long. The big question to me for the Diamondbacks is if Zach Greinke doesn't go seven innings, who's going to bridge that gap with Archie Bradley and Fernando Rodney at the end? Their bullpen has been their weakness all year long. The bullpen has been a relative strength for the Rockies, and you wonder if this turns into a bullpen game, whether Colorado does end up with the advantage.
Jeff, one more thing. You were on a story that I want to ask you about. In the middle of all of this, Atlanta's general manager, John Coppola, resigned in the middle of a complete mess. In fact, one Braves employee told you, quote, "This place is totally bleeped up. I just hope when it blows up, it doesn't take all of us down," end quote. Not often you hear somebody in an organization say something like that. So in a nutshell, how jacked up is it? Exactly what's happening in Atlanta?
It's the most dysfunctional place I've seen in my 15 or so years of covering baseball, just in terms of everybody turning on the general manager. And John Coppola got fired, or resigned technically, but was forced to resign because Major League Baseball found violations of international rules. But this went a lot deeper than that. Major League Baseball was looking into the violations of international rules because people from his own organization ratted him out to the league. Like, when you have engendered that much hate from within your own organization, and it's matched, frankly, around baseball, it's a pretty bad situation. And in some ways, you have to feel bad for John Coppola, who is not the sort of guy who typically ascends to the top of the baseball rung, but he did so at 36 years old, and he was in the catbird seat, and through mismanagement, both personality-wise as well as resource-wise, he's never going to work in baseball again.
Keenan in Albuquerque asks, "Jim O's, my man, whatever happened to Alvy's mix? Last I remembered, that thing was dope as hell. Wore you, Romy. Wore little Alvy, too. But most of all, wore Alvy's mix." God, that's a great point. That's a good, good question. Alvy's mix pretty much went by the wayside when Alvy started to do the week that was. Because before there was a week that was, Alvy would just drop in his infamous mix whenever we felt like it was appropriate. Alvy, do you still have that thing anywhere? Do you still have the last version of the mix? All right, so before we roll this, what was the last version? What year was the last version of the mix? Like probably 2015, 2012? Dude, you have not done the week that was 5 years. Come on. I was like, oh, no, dude, I have. Trust me, dude. I know exactly how many years I've done that. I can say how many days I've done that. Oh, no, dude, I've done that. Alvy, I haven't seen you get that defensive in a long time. Oh, no, no, dude, I've done the week that was exactly 7,438 days and 48 hours. Oh, I know, I've done that, Vance Mack. All right, so this guy brings it up. In fact, if it's gone on 5 years, a lot of you don't even know about Alvin's mix. I would love to know where that thing ended up or dropped off or stopped off. Alvin, roll the last version of your mix.
I tell you once again.
I need to have that on my iPod.
Gordon!
Both you guys in college and get your mom's back done.
Ponder passing.
I'm an Asian. The friendly ghost. The friendliest ghost you know.
And I mean forever.
I am verbally murdering this inbred.
Great interview with Deion Branch.
Bitch. I mean, what are you, the great
fight to the death? They don't just fight.
His name is Jim Rowe.
And in contrast, but not in...
Rista!
Doggy dog.
Oh, man.
You know?
I'm the top. I'm the bottle on the top ship.
You don't like that car.
What's his middle name?
Is anybody hitting anyone right now?
What's going on?
Ridge.
Ooh, beg you, in house.
What the heck's going on, Giles?
Ricky Cleek.
Playoffs?
If you want to crown them, then crown her.
What do you mean? Dad, it's 9 now.
It's Division I football.
Come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40.
I like Bill.
What do you want to talk about, clone?
Can I call you Romy?
Tell me it's not just another show.
They only put poor people in jail.
The jungle is alive.
It's too much down there, man.
We will play in a national title.
Bow down before your king, you sir.
The Giants win the pennant.
Hopefully your choke is just a bogey.
Have you ever seen a face that oily before?
Hey!
Love the pitch, don't you?
I parked my car in garages smaller than this guy's nostrils.
How's it going?
I get benefits and you don't.
Hi, my name's Bill.
No disrespect.
Ranger Rick on the golf course.
I need a ground.
It's a thin line.
We'll talk to you soon.
About 60, 65.
You know who the hell I am.
Roger Penske organization.
Yvonne.
Sticking out of her ass.
Chasing all the tramps around America League.
Class act, buddy.
Brutal. Kick your butt right here.
Necks and cuts of a blade.
Correct.
You're gonna pay.
Vegan cheesecake.
All right, just take the oil.
All right, everybody.
Other than spit, I just...
John, a friendly man.
We're really thoughtless little pig.
Dr. Boudreaux.
Get your punk ass ate up.
I made your butthole poker up.
Have I... given you enough to talk about?
Run! Go move!
Ain't no way.
Vance Mack. 1-800. You like them apples?
Makes me want to puke.
You see a cat, mate?
A spaghetti.
What's the matter with you?
Collard greens or whatever.
Jim, first of all, it's 25 million.
25 million reasons.
You got a homemade microphone.
Racing some Visalign.
It's like a big midget.
He said.
I do declare.
Dude, oh man.
In New York.
Play. Don't play.
Ridiculous.
Fat.
Let's play.
Hello.
All right, linebacker.
Boom.
Yeah.
Got him.
Good night.
Yeah.
Give me back my fat.
Right.
Young crackmate.
That's incredible. So that was Alvy's mix back in the day before he started doing the week that was. Sometimes we'd actually try to run that thing in double speed if we didn't have enough time.
Back the game. I play that, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Six
pack.
What are we talking about?
Ohio State sucks.
Ohio State still
sucks.
His brother's
Pedro. I just got on libel of sexual harassment by my point guard. He's down by the Celtics.
Rex is a dog named Vladimir or Billy.
You talking about practice?
Idiot kicker.
Rose your downs disgusting.
You whining little babies in this week.
Feel the zero field on me.
Don't get high face and don't talk back to me. All right.
Monkey.
I have never steroids.
Boho period.
Please.
Certainly, Duke is Duke.
I like my chances.
I'm the Sean Kemp of the dark side.
You just got a little rich. I feel like an elephant. You got all these great memories.
Man, candy.
Right, that's double speed. Sometimes, and we do that if we were running out of time, but if we had more time than we ever needed, I would go the other way and play it in half speed.
Hey.
Fast.
Tell your game, man.
How play is that, man?
Yeah!
Give me back my son!
My son back!
Monkeys.
Chew it!
Why?
Nerd!
Six pack ass.
The coaches are screwing it up!
As you can imagine, that would take all afternoon to get to the end of that. So we'd play it in regular speed, double speed, half speed, and even sometimes we'd roll it backwards.
Half.
Homie tweets, holy crap, awesome. Like the last 20 years of my mornings in 3 minutes. Clones, thank you very much for listening, and thank you for downloading the Jim Rome Podcast. We're less than 24 hours after episode 6 dropped. And it's already our most downloaded podcast. So if you haven't heard it, come listen to my conversations with Damian Lillard and Brian Koppelman. Some of you clones are calling it the best episode we've had yet. And on top of that, of course, your crappy voicemails, and I'm going to call them the worst we've had yet. Check back here tomorrow for more Daily Jungle. See you then. I'm out.